Good morning. I'm Judy Ellis. I'm professor of neurology at the University of British Columbia and director of the new National Core for Neuroethics in Vancouver. And I'm here with Professor Hank Greeley from the Stanford Law School, my old friend and colleague. We're here to talk about a number of issues related to neuroethics, both about the genesis of the society and its future, as well as some of the work that Hank has been leading in the area of law and neuroscience. So I'd like to start with a first question for you, Hank, which is really based on my memories of traveling with you to Washington several years ago and meeting with Mr. Sapphire from the Dana Foundation about the possibility of a neuroethics society. So tell us how you remember that experience. What message did you come away with from him?
He was very supportive of the idea. He was very supportive in general of the idea of neuroethics. My main recollection of that is just what a charming, fascinating guy he was and what a font of not so recent American political history he was, a subject that interests me. So I think there were times, as I recall in that conversation, we may have been boring you because we were focusing on American political history instead of neuroethics. But I remember being excited coming away from that thinking this could actually happen. And it was with the Dana Foundation grant that we held our first meeting at Asilomar. So Bill Sapphire and Dana were deeply instrumental in the fact that we're here at the first annual meeting of the Neuroethics Society.
Oh, I definitely agree with you. We have a lot of gratitude that we owe them, both for their support and also for their vision from as early back as 2002, and ever since then they've been really pillars of our efforts. Let me ask you a little bit about some forecasts from you. At UBC last year, you were our first Brain Awareness Week special lecturer, another major event sponsored by the Dana Foundation. And at UBC, one of your lectures was called Neuroscience and the Law, a Long-Range Forecast. So what was your forecast then, and is it the same now?
I don't think the forecast has changed. Like any long-range forecast, it's not very specific. At least any long-range forecast that hopes to be accurate has to be pretty general and somewhat vague. But I think I still see the future climate for law and neuroscience pretty much the way I did last year. I think this is going to be an area that I think neuroscience will inevitably have a substantial effect on legal systems in the United States, Canada, and everywhere else, because the law really cares about brains. Or it thinks it cares about minds, but as we know, it actually cares about brains, given that the mind is generated by the brain. If it has any, if it's useful to think of it as it all separate from the brain, it's certainly generated by the brain. As we learn more about how brains work, that'll affect the legal system in lots of areas. The five general categories I tend to throw those into are issues of prediction, issues of mind reading, issues of responsibility and consciousness, issues of treatment, and issues of enhancement. And in each one of those, there will be both indirect effects on the law. So when society changes, the law changes. When it becomes possible for us to predict things like future onset of Alzheimer's disease, then there becomes a concern about discrimination against people who are at risk for Alzheimer's disease, which generates a legal reaction. In the case of genetic discrimination, ultimately in the United States, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, I think a lot of the neuroscience activity will indirectly affect the law by changing what the underlying policies and laws of societies are. But it's also going to have direct effects in the courtroom, direct effects in the legal system through things like efforts at fMRI-based lie detection. So I don't, you know, I can't say whether it's going to rain or not on November 14th, 2010 at Stanford. I can say it's a lot more likely to rain in November than it is in June. I think that neuroscience is going to have substantial effects in the legal system. Exactly where they are is, of course, impossible to be sure of. But I think they'll fall into those five general categories.
So you're one of the directors of, I think, a very major project called the Law and Neuroscience Project, funded by the MacArthur Foundation, and it's being led by Mike Gazzaniga. Can you tell us a little bit about that project and specifically how it interfaces with neuroethics and with your interests in inferring mental states from brain scans and other technology?
The Law and Neuroscience Project currently has a 3-year grant from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation to look at how neuroscience is going to affect criminal law. We're about halfway through that first 3-year period and hope and expect to have it renewed for a much longer term investigation. Right now, the MacArthur Project, or the Law and Neuroscience Project, is only looking at criminal law, which I think is useful as a starting place, but I hope we'll broaden out from that. And we're really looking in two broad areas. One is the set of issues around responsibility. We have one of our two networks is looking at criminal responsibility and punishment. And the other one is looking more broadly at issues of legal decision-making or of decision-making relevant to law. It's not just the decision-making of jurors and judges, of policemen and prosecuting attorneys, but also the decision-making of criminals that ends up getting them in trouble with the law to begin with. So we're moving forward with little research grants within the networks to try to understand a number of those issues better. Many of the people involved in this project are also involved in neuroethics. I think of it as kind of a Venn diagram where these are overlapping sets, but not completely overlapping sets. Some of the people interested in the legal issues are not members of the Neuroethics Society and would think that they shouldn't be because they view their interests more narrowly. I argue to them that they should be because I think neuroethics encompasses a very broad range of ethical, legal, and social implications of law. But you've got people looking at narrow pieces that have relevance for the legal system, as well as people who are looking more broadly at the major social changes that may come about as a result of neuroscience that will affect the legal system. So it's kind of a rambling answer, but I think the MacArthur Project is it's a work in progress. We'll see how it all turns out, but we've got an awful lot of good people working hard to try to come up with and then begin to answer some discrete questions that'll help us understand better how neuroscience is going to affect the legal system. And certainly, we hope, help us to make sure that those effects maximize the benefits and minimize the harms.
I want to push a little further on this topic. So as a member of the project, I've noticed that we are investing heavily in functional MRI, so in using brain scans that make measurements of the function of the brain using changes in blood and oxygen levels. And how do you feel about putting so many eggs in that imaging basket? What can functional MRI really tell us about the criminal mind, psychopaths, decision-making, moral responsibility, even the way that we make decisions in courtrooms?
Well, I think that's two great questions rolled into one. We don't know what functional MRI can tell us about issues relevant to the law. One of the things I think the project hopes to do is begin to sketch out where it can be useful, where it can't be useful. It's really kind of amazing that it's become the technology du jour in a lot of the discussions of ELSI issues, ethical, legal, and social issues in neuroscience. When you think about the fact that all it does is measure blood flow, or measure the percentage of oxygenated versus deoxygenated blood, from which we draw conclusions about areas of the brain that have been active and have been inactive, relatively inactive, areas of the brain that have been more active or less active, where the areas are defined in ways that include hundreds of thousands of neurons in many cases. So I think there's some real limitations to the technique, both the noise signal-to-noise ratios in the technique, but also what a technique that looks at patterns of blood flow or alternatively of energy use inside small but from a neuron's perspective fairly large chunks of brain ultimately will be able to tell us. So to me, one of the key tensions in this work, and I owe this insight in part to a reaming out I got from a British academic named Nicholas Rose, who lit into me one day and said, you know, you keep talking about this lie detection stuff and the implications of lie detection, and whenever you worry about the Fifth Amendment implications of fMRI-based lie detection, the people listening to you are a little more convinced that this stuff is real and will actually happen. So I think we have to walk a very narrow line. On the one hand, I do think it's important for us to ask, if this stuff works, what are the social implications? What are the legal implications? What are the ethical implications? But on the other hand, as you and I know from our work together on lie detection, we also have to constantly be asking, does this stuff work? Does it work today? Is it likely to work tomorrow? How will we know whether it works or not? How do we assess its efficacy? Those kinds of issues have to be balanced against the more forecasting, futuristic issues. We need to do both. The other question I saw lodged in your question really intrigues me. I do think fMRI is the technology du jour. You and others have done work showing the exponential increase in publications involving fMRI. And yet there are a lot of neuroscience technologies out there. A lot of people are interested in hormones, stress and other hormone levels. People are interested in EEG still. People are interested in using transcranial magnetic stimulation to intervene or to knock out areas of brain to study it. I worry that we're focusing too much on fMRI, not just because it has limitations, because all technologies have limitations, but because it's hot and trendy, and we may not be paying enough attention to the more long-standing and perhaps less currently exciting technologies like EEG, like, to some extent, issues, the neurochemical or hormonal issues. Part of that, I have to say, does stem from the science. It's a lot easier to do an fMRI of somebody than it is to measure levels of dopamine in specific regions of a living brain. We can't do that right now very easily, and I'm not sure that we ever will be able to. So there's some technical issues as well. But I do think we need to take a step back and say, are we watching all the technologies we should be watching?
The power might really be in the combination of technologies as we move into the future. But just quickly, I did read in a recent issue of Science magazine that a portable MRI is to be released. And so I think that really does bring us back to issues of lie detection and application. And in a paper I had the pleasure of co-authoring with you, we called for a regulation. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that very quickly as we wrap up here today.
I am convinced that we should not allow fMRI-based or, frankly, any other form of technologically-based lie detection to be used in society unless or until it's been proven safe and effective. It's the standard we apply to drugs. Lie detection has the potential to be at least as significant in a social sense as many drugs are in a medical sense. It has the potential to be widely misused, particularly since going back in history to the 85 years ago, to the early adoption of the polygraph. We see a longing of some sort for some sort of magic technological fix to tell us when people are lying and when they aren't. I worry a lot that society will adopt these technologies before they should, and the result will be some innocent people will go to jail and some guilty people won't go to jail. There will always be type 1 and type 2 errors, but you can have a lot more of them if you're making these decisions based on untried, untested, and probably invalid technologies. That's where I think we are today. The fact that there are two companies selling these services in the United States right now strikes me as, at best, reckless. I'd like to see it stopped, at least until we have generally acceptable proof that it's actually effective.
Well, in fact, there might be more than two companies now. There's two known companies.
Right.
But, you know, your comments are, for me, one of the best forms of validation for the need for the kind of society that we've worked so hard to establish and brought really here to the AAAS today. So, last moment of your hopes and dreams for the future of the society?
I hope it'll continue to expand and flourish. I hope it will continue to have a very broad view of what neuroethics is about. That we really are interested in the ethical, legal, social implications of our expansion of knowledge about the human brain and human cognitive functions, that if we ever try to narrow our scope down, I think we'll be making a mistake, because it's always hard to predict things, especially the future. It's hard to know what areas will turn out to be most important, but I'm pretty confident that I can accurately say this area, neuroscience, will have major effects on our societies.